Thanks for tuning in to Jin and Tantra. In this episode, we continue our discussion on the obstacles to development via the lens of the Taoist tradition by highlighting one of the obstacles, the pressure from our families. We also discuss facing responsibility within authentic response and developing passion as a tool for self-esteem. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Jin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes Tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, Shamanism, Chinese medicineism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail. Your spirit has been longing for.
I want you to get together.
Now, isn't that refreshing?
I want you to get together.
Hey, fellow GNTers, those of us who like our spirituality with a twist. Okay, so we got into this idea of doing this Taoist concept of the nine obstacles. These are nine things in life that can kind of get in your way and generally fuck things up. It's also, Danny and I were talking, you know, pre-being on mic, it's also kind of the idea for maybe a little book for us. We've been talking about doing a little Jin and Tantra book for a while, and maybe this will be part of the form of the book. So this is multitasking, I think.
Yes, this is
it's a little bit of like, yeah.
Public brainstorm. Yeah. So
yes, the episode, and we were joking, if you want to get in the book, send over a comment.
That's right.
We'll see
right.
If it makes it in there, right?
Yeah. We could just do a page of comments just randomly. I mean, you know, whatever. So
these guys suck.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. That guy's so repetitive and boring.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That guy's so handsome. What's he doing there?
Yeah. I won't make a say which one of us. I'll leave that just
That's right. That's right.
All right. So we did obstacle one, which had a lot to do with like fear and insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
And in a realistic way, kind of the scarier parts of life. Obstacle number two, in a simple phrase, it would be sort of being smothered by parental demands, is the way they put it in the old Taoist books that we're referencing.
Mm-hmm.
And basically people being kind of crushed by the demands of their family of origin and their parents, and the idea that you have to break away from this.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an amazing story about this, which I guess might be my lead. I can see if I get permission for it to be in a book. I think maybe we talked about it in the episode we did before on this, but I went to this very unusual party. It was a small group of people. And the idea was that people would talk about some major point of transition in their lives.
Mm.
And some people even dressed in costume to represent that period of their life. And the amazing story came from one of the attendees at the party. And she was talking about going to med school. And at a certain point, she just realized, I don't think she really even fully got how unhappy she was. Obviously, on some level, she wasn't happy with it. And she said in a lot of situations, she found herself disagreeing with what the standards of treatment were. And she had arguments with people who were higher up in the food chain than her, you know, supervisors and, you know, as a resident. But she was saying, like, I wouldn't recommend that to my grandma. I wouldn't recommend that to a family member. Why are mm-hmm. we doing this to people? You know?
Sure.
So she's having a lot of issues with it. I think on some level, I've talked to a couple people who know her about this. And they were like, yeah, there was family pressure involved. I think she downplayed it a little bit. But certainly part of it was expectation, you know, of mm-hmm. family things.
Mm-hmm.
Her family here were immigrants from another country. They came here. They were, you know, there were ambitions around that for the kids. And so she found herself in med school. And the trippy thing is, at a certain point, she was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. Like, she was getting physically ill to the point where even like the Western medical tests were coming back really negative. So it wasn't just what we sometimes call like a somatoform disorder,
mm-hmm.
where it was just psychological and the medical tests were all coming back within normal limits. But the tests were coming back too. And they thought maybe she had a pituitary tumor. And, you know, it was getting quite serious. And at some point, in the biggest, most dramatic part, she completely lost her ability to see. Like, she lost her eyesight.
Wow.
Gone. And so it was a medical mess and a bit of a medical mystery. But I mean, obviously there were diagnostic indications that were going, okay, there's something seriously wrong. It wasn't just the symptoms, which can happen, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you and I deal with cases like this, you know, psychologically dramatic things can happen to the body, but usually don't find any damage, right?
Right.
But in this case, it wasn't just that. There was also damage being done to the body, which can happen too, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Chinese medicine, we talk about the internal causes. And, you know, the emotions are the internal causes and they can damage the body. So anyways, this was an amazing story, Daniel. And it hit this climactic point where she was just like, I can't do this anymore. I can't go to med school.
Mm.
I can't do it. And she just stopped it and went on and decided that she was going to go more into like the social sciences, sociology, anthropology, those kinds of things, which was obviously not what her parents wanted.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted her to be a doctor. And within 3 months, everything was gone. All the symptoms disappeared.
Mm.
So she was cured within 3 months. And it was just a question of her like resisting and fighting off what the expectations of her going in. So I thought, well, that's a hell of a story.
Mm.
And I knew we were going to do these episodes. So I went and I asked her, you know, we were getting some wine or whatever. And I said, do you mind if I share this? I'll do it anonymously, of course. And she was like, cool, do it. And I thought, okay, that's my lead story in this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because that gets you about as dramatic as you can get into something like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously it wasn't just wrecking her life. It was destroying her inside and emotionally, and then destroying her body. You know, I was thinking about that. I was talking with my son about Jesus. Mm. Yeah. We had done these episodes on Jesus.
Yeah.
He's very anti-Christian, more so than I ever was or are. Mm. I don't know where it comes from. He has some funny karma. He's very against it. Like, he's been very definitive on that. And I'm like, well, back it up a little bit, you know.
Yeah, you're 10. So, just call, yeah, you know.
Well, he's 11 now, but okay. Still, you know,
yeah.
The rite of passage is still coming, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was like, take it easy. And I was saying, well, you might like Gnostic Jesus. What about Gnostic Jesus?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, what's that about? And I was trying to say, well, it's more where you get the philosophical teachings, right? As opposed to just a story. And I was reminded of that one from the Gospel of Thomas. It's one of my favorite ones where the quote goes, if you bring out that which is within you, what you bring out will save you. If you do not bring out that which is within you, what you do not bring out will destroy you. And it's kind of an incredible quote about like authenticity.
Sure.
So I was sort of asking my son, like, what do you think this is about? And he was like, I wasn't quite sure. I said, well, if you think about it this way, and maybe I even talked a little bit about this lady who'd gone through this thing, you know, if it gets that inauthentic, it'll eat you up from the inside.
Sure.
Right. As a spiritual teaching. So that was the example I felt like I would probably kind of lead with in this. And do you have one that you want to share?
A story, not particularly a story, but I think I was thinking about this as, you know, you were talking. Uh-huh. And what comes to my mind immediately is the, you know, the breaking the chains of our own familial lineage, you know. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be, and there's probably, you know, probably something maybe I'll save for the written version of this conversation. But I think, you know, my mom grew up in a, you know, they were immigrants, you know, grew up in a very kind of religious household, very strong culture, you know, and there's many people who have this, but the good part about culture, I think, is that it provides a network for people to like grow within, you know, and learn things that are, you know, shared by other people who they look like, whom they share their life with, and probably up until recently, never left. Mm-hmm. Most people never moved like this, you know. I mean, before we were nomadic, but once we've been kind of, you know, relatively civilized, this is what you were. So this is how we celebrate birthdays. This is how we celebrate life and celebrate, you know, the passing of it and everything else. So that was like something that you were sort of born within and you could grow mm-hmm. into as life grew, and then you pass that down to your children and so on and so forth. However, this is also unfortunately known as conditioning.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so having this responsibility upon yourself via your family definitely can lead you, as I think society is growing a little bit more, at least towards, I'll say, an enlightened state. I know very far from it on the whole, but at least, you know, the whole is the sum of the parts, and the individuals are waking up to like, I don't want this for myself. This doesn't feel authentic. This, the Shen, the spirit, the soul is speaking, you know, for some people more than others, but they're saying, that's not me. Like the story of that woman that you just brought up, That's not me. I know what my family wants, but I literally can't do it. It's killing me, you know? And so she has to wait. Unfortunately for her, she had to go through something really difficult in order to realize that. But I think some people might realize that sooner and be like, no, I'm just not doing that at all. I'm not even going down that road. And so breaking the chains of the familial, of the, her, you know, the inherited kind of, not obstacles, but like tendencies, if you will, that this is absolutely part of that kind of thing. And then I think it's really important actually to start, maybe not start there, but have it on your mind as like, I have to go through things that I am part, that are literally part of me, you know, part of what I was born within. And sometimes they're not even conscious, actually. It has to be sort of brought to your attention. But all the things in order to help yourself gain more power of your own decision makings and your own reactivities in this way, this is part of it. You know, figuring out who it is that you actually are outside of what you are told that you are by even your parents or your aunts and uncles or whatever culture you're in. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I felt, it does. And I guess it might depend on a little bit on like each of our individual experiences. I definitely felt some of this on a personal level. I don't know how it was for you. My mom wanted me to go to Western Medical School for sure. And there was always this push in that direction. And my dad had this idea of going to corporate America and that everyone should just go, because he saw it associated with a kind of a job security, which now seems very ironic.
Right.
But at his time, he felt like that was the case. And then you'd get a retirement package and you'd be secure. Like we talked about in the previous episode, I think he was scarred by insecurity, right?
Yeah.
And that idea of the family lineage, like that you maybe carry those things in you, we talked about from that point of view too. You know, it's obviously an important idea for you in the shamanistic sense of things, right? You carry those things. So those were the kind of the pressures that I felt. And I mean, I knew I wasn't going to do those things at a certain point, but I did feel like I had to resist. And I was very struck by, you know, these stories of kind of resisting this. I mean, that did matter to me, you know, and some of them, you know, the more inspiring ones. What hit me in this little section over here is like the Buddhist story has this quality to it, right? Where it's a story of a guy who resists his father, at least in part, right? From the very moment of his birth, his father wants him to be a king. From the very moment, his father is the king, if you don't know the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
So his father's the king, Buddha's born in this family. Sometimes the story is more magical. Buddha comes out as this special being from the very beginning, and
right.
Even as a baby, he's walking around and like, there's stories like that.
Uh-huh.
Pops out of the womb. He points to the heaven. He points to the earth. I will unite everything. That's a magical story. But some of them are more realistic, you know, in the sense of like, okay, here's a person who's born into this royal lineage and his father no doubt wants him to be a king. And, you know, a lot of times the backstory is that his father sees the astrologers right when his son is born. And they say, well, the charts kind of say two things could happen. He could become a great ruler and, you know, have this incredibly expansive kingdom, or he'll be a spiritual teacher and his spiritual teaching will expand. And that's obvious, you know, his father's a king, so it's clear what he wants him to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not the second one.
Mm-mm.
And so, you know, the whole backstory of the story is him trying to set up the life within the palace. Sometimes it's told a little bit like it's Aladdin or something in Jasmine. Like she's just locked in the palace and never gets to go out or something. If you've seen the cartoon, you know, sometimes it's like that. I'll protect him from the world completely so he doesn't have any negative experiences and he doesn't decide he's going to be a spiritual teacher. The Aladdin version of the story. But whatever, I mean, you could, whether or not you believe in that kind of like Aladdin part, you don't even need it. It's obvious that his father wants him to be a king.
Right.
And he's kind of angling in that direction. And at a certain point, Buddha has to break, mm-hmm. you know, and disappoint his father.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's way, way back in the day. But when I first heard these stories, I was a teenager and it was Joseph Campbell, right?
Yeah.
Joey C. And he was, you know, talking on, you know, public television and he was going through the temptations of the Buddha. And the one was around kind of desire. You know, all these beautiful figures appear to him. Am I going to be like entranced by desire? And one was around fear. Maybe the fear one came first. You know, the demons of hell come flying in on you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fear, it's desire. But then the third one was like social responsibility.
Mm.
You're going to let your family down. You're not doing what other people need from you. Like that was the capper one. And I remember hearing that as a teenager going, huh, that's deep actually. You know, it was a little bit easier to relate to those than even the ones that you get maybe in our Catholic or Christian upbringing. which are a little bit more kind of out there. You know, they're not as obvious temptations.
Right.
They're still deep. I'm not saying they're not, you know, Satan takes Jesus to the mountain and says, jump off and God will save you. And he says, don't tempt the Lord your God. I mean, they're still deep, you know, but this was kind of a story that I can more relate to as a teenager. I went, oh yeah, I can imagine something like that, to feel that familial pressure, you know, to have to do things, even in ways that are more subtle. But from what you're talking about, it doesn't seem like you felt that very much, right?
I did not, but I mean, I came because my mom carried that pressure with her. She did that for herself.
Oh, so she felt that pressure. And she broke with it.
She got it.
Yeah, she broke with it.
I mean, it was insane for her.
And that's in the episode that we did together, right?
Yeah, for sure. And briefly for those who, you know, have never heard it, like, you know, my mom came here with the family and she was about 13. Mm-hmm. And she was the first one to speak English. So she was responsible for all of the everything to get the family acquainted, do all the paperwork, everything, you know?
Yeah, I've heard that story before from like kids who come here and they're the first ones to learn English. I've heard that from students.
Yeah.
Who have families from other countries and things. Yeah.
But she was also like a budding yogi, you know?
Yeah.
She wanted to learn yoga postures and meditation and things like this. And when she finally, you know, they knew she was going to go to school, college, because everybody else, you know, was going to get married very young. And she was like, no, I'm not doing that. Probably because she had other boyfriends or something too, you know, but she didn't want that for herself. She went to school and numerous times within the first like month of her being there, her dad and or her brothers would literally go to her dorm, take her stuff, pack it in the car and drive it back home.
Mm.
So she had to do this over and over and over again. And then one of her brothers didn't talk to her. I don't know how long it was, 10 years after she graduated.
Mm-hmm.
Not because he was particularly mad about anything she did. It's what she didn't do. She didn't become a lawyer. She became a nurse, and that bothered him.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Because of the obvious money advantages of being a lawyer, and it's not the wife.
Because it would be more beneficial for the family. You know what I'm saying? And so, like, there's this. So she carried the brunt of that burden. And so us being the children of her, we didn't get any of that, you know, not to mention that she married outside of the culture. And so my brother and I were, you know, even, you know, they're just like, okay, whatever. Are you kids are not fuck ups? All right. That's probably good enough. You know, like
you're not in jail. You're not like destitute.
Yeah. We can't ask much out of you, you know, and then my parents got divorced when I was young. So my family felt bad, you know, for us because nobody else was. And so, yeah, there was no pressure at all.
Yeah, I wonder about that. So I think my son is probably, and my daughter are the first ones to not feel that in our little lineage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I was talking with my son over the weekend again, and he just said something like, you know, it's an interesting family situation because there's nothing for me to rebel against exactly. Because I can do whatever I want and I'm kind of supported generally. And I was like, yep, that's kind of by design.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we'll see what happens as he gets older. You know, you might figure out things you want to rebel against later, obviously.
Sure.
And that's natural enough, but you know, hopefully not as much. And then we were talking and I said, you know, it's kind of a Zen thing. I want to get to the spirituality of all of this. One of my favorite things from Shunryu Suzuki, I think it's in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, just in that one, but he talks about like putting a fence around a bull. And if you put a fence around the bull, the first thing the bull is going to do is charge the fence.
Right.
But if you don't put a fence at all, the bull might stand in that exact same spot because the bull would just be like, hey, there's no fence. No one's bothering me. I'll just chill here.
Right.
You know? So that's a little bit kind of the attitude behind this. The minute you put that fence up, people are going to feel like that need to challenge that boundary, which is interesting, you know? And we had like kind of a long conversation about like that feeling.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, I mean, that is the goal. Whatever you want to do, we'll try to support you in it. You know, he loves chess. So we have realistic conversations about what it means for him to be a chess player.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows how good you're going to be at something like that. That's kind of like wanting to be a professional baseball player or something.
He's pretty good, though.
He is good. And he was number one in the state for a while. Now he's not. I think that like is a dagger through his heart. Nah, it's not. He's okay with it. He's okay with it. He seems to like do okay even when he's not doing as great because he loves it. He definitely has the LTG, right? Love of the game. But, you know, I like, okay, well, you know, I don't know if this is going to work out for you or not, but, you know, it could always be a part of your life and I'm going to support you in doing it. It's obviously going to make him a better person.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I didn't get that growing up for sure. You know, I can't remember if we talked about it in the last episode, but I loved music growing up. And I was talking with somebody about it recently. Maybe it was Ryan Davenport. And my dad would come in and he would just be like, you suck. And I would be like, dude, I'm just practicing this piece. He'd be like, no, you're terrible. And it was his way of discouraging me. Because he thought if he thought I was I mean, yeah. That wasn't obvious. Well, that does sound a little discouraging. Now that you mention it.
It was his way of insulting me. Oh, okay. Got it. All right. Yeah, that makes sense.
But I think there was a philosophy behind it, but I was trying to get to. But that's true. That does sound a little discouraging, just on the surface. I'd have to read between the lines.
Yeah.
He wasn't a subtle man on this point. But he went out of his way to do it. It was like, I didn't even ask you to listen to this shit.
Right, yeah.
But it was more like he felt like he wanted to discourage me from doing this thing because he was so afraid. I tried to do something professional in that range and it wouldn't work out. And I get hurt and disappointed. Or I think the insecurity part, you know, that I would be financially vulnerable and so on. So anyways, you know, I think with my son, I'm like, well, listen, you know, you'll probably have to have a backup plan, but you know, we'll try to help you figure out how to do this. I'll try to help you figure out how to do it. So I, you know, I guess people are listening and I have different stories around this for sure.
Yeah.
Right. I guess the other one I wanted to mention real quick that made an impact on me when I was younger was from, you know, one of our favorite psychologists on the show, Carl Rogers. We love our Carls and Jung and Rogers. And so he had this case study. Sometimes I think share it with students. I read it in a book of his case studies back in undergrad psych, and it just hit me like really strongly. It's called The Case of Ellen West. It wasn't really his patient. It was sort of, I guess, a well-known case study that had gone terribly, terribly wrong. Mm-hmm. And they brought in other clinicians to comment on it. So they went through sort of the case notes and said, what might we have done differently to not have this case end in tragedy? No reason to hold off till the end. Like, it's about a young woman who like takes her own life. So, you know, it's a terrible case study and Carl Rogers is looking at it. And of course he's a modest person. You know, he's going to say, I don't know if I could have totally solved this, but I did read through it. And the one thing that always hit me so strongly in the case, which always gets to me when I see patients is for this Ellen West, every time she tried to do something like what that lady did, I'm not going to med school. No. Anytime she tried to like rebel back against the family demands, they kind of crushed her.
Mm.
And it was always from this point of view of like good intentions. You know, no, what you're doing isn't right. There's a better plan for you. You're not seeing this clearly. No. And they would talk her out of it or maybe more forcefully try to get her out of it. And it happened over and over and over again. So she would try to go through and say, okay, I'm going to go and study this in school. And they talk her out of it.
Mm.
Or she tried to do something else for life, they talk her out of it. And I think it hit a pinnacle where she had fallen in love with this guy who was an artist. And she really loved him and she really loved art. And so she really wanted to be with him. And ultimately there was a lot of familial pressure that was put on her to break this relationship up and go back into the family fold. And you know, she would every time this would happen, Rogers notices the pattern. She would fall into this depression. They would medicalize it as the family because they're like, okay, they weren't looking at it from themselves, obviously. They were doing what was the wise thing to do, making the wise choices. There must be something wrong with her in terms of a mental illness. And so they kept taking her in to be seen.
Right.
And it kept getting medicalized, you know? So in this thing where they finally kind of force her to end this relationship, she obviously, in this case, got extremely despondent and fell into like, you know, major depressive episode. And in the end, took her own life at the end of it. And I remember reading that one as a student and just going, okay, yeah, I could see how things like that can play themselves out.
Mm.
You know? And maybe I had some sensitivity from my own life, but certainly you see cases like this lady I saw at the party, you know, the Carl Rogers case in this situation. I can't remember if I talked about it. I had another one that a patient shared with me. We were talking about this issue and she told me one from her own life. Where she was involved with this guy who was Greek. It was kind of like what happened maybe with your mom. You know, this guy was outside the family.
Mm-hmm.
She's Latino. And so, you know, they just didn't approve of this. And they had some kind of family business. And eventually, to get him to break the relationship up, they were like, okay, we're gonna like force you out of the family business if you don't break up with this person. Like, we're staying within our group, and basically you're gonna have to like function within the family and follow the direction of the family, And so eventually he did. I think that was the thing that kind of broke him. He had other pressures on him, but when they were like, okay, we're financially cutting you off and we're cutting you out of the business, something happened within him, probably back to obstacle one. He felt insecure, right? What we were talking about before, the insecurity. And so then he went back and did what the family said and broke up. And then she said she saw him a year later, and she was saying he was a good-looking guy, lively. And when she saw him the next time, he had put on a bunch of weight. He was obviously looked like he was maybe drinking, being more self-destructive. And she thought, well, this is tragic. And then we had a conversation about the Carl Rogers thing. And it's like, oh yeah, this is what happens, when people get broken in this way. And obviously Carl Rogers is very, sensitized to that kind of question of authenticity, which is exactly what the lady was talking about in the party. If you lose your authenticity, you can, you can get really sick.
So I'm thinking of somebody whom I'm related to and who's definitely having a difficult time in their life, as I feel like many young men are during this time, right? There's less men significantly, and that the trend is going in one direction only. There are far more women in college than men. Like, that's
That's true.
just, and there's just a whole lot, there's a whole host of things, right? Jordan Peterson has a lane in society because he's talking to despondent men who don't have strong role model or who don't have some kind of internal motivational factor and some like penciled neck whack ass pseudo psychologist is their guru. You know what I'm saying?
That's
Like,
Jordan Peterson. That's your description of
yeah,
Jordan
that's
Peterson.
Jordan Peterson. I don't respect any of his work other than the fact that like it's very basic. And there is some value in just saying and stating the obvious. So for those whom have found it beneficial, okay, that's cool. Like that's the death dealing with the security, this the how we talked about it last episode, like the food insecurity type of mentality. You need to work, you got to show up, and that's important. But my question, and I
Daniel,
want to
just real
just
quick, I don't want to kill your flow, but you and Christian did those episodes that were sort of more on your men's retreats, right? And I almost sometimes feel like part of this podcast, I would like to be reaching out to the male audience, reaching out to everyone, but to the male part of the audience to say, there's another way to do this. You don't have to go around this Jordan Peterson route, right? Because ultimately, he's like, if you don't know anything about him, he's very niche. Like I've talked with people, and a lot of people are like, I never heard of this guy. But within a certain part of the world, he's an important figure, right? Especially for, people who feel uncertain, maybe dealing with issues of self-confidence, male people, right? Younger men. And I just want to give you kudos for the Christian episode, and also just kind of like point that out, because I feel like it's a good thing y'all are doing, and I hope that that works in these other episodes too. Just say, hey, you don't have to go around that route,
Yeah,
because
you
ends
don't
up
have
being
to.
very conservative. He's a very politically conservative activist on some level.
Correct.
So he's sort of pulling people far to the right. Anyways, I didn't mean to interrupt your flow, but I just wanted to kind of talk about that, to talk about the episode and for that context,
So, he's a bit of a fire starter for some people who need that. And so there's benefit in that, right? I'm not going to say he's useless. I'm going to just say I don't respect that kind of only contributing to the bottom rung. You know what I'm saying? Like there's more than one rung. And so the discussion beyond just simple turning yourself into a good worker is not the end of the conversation. And I think that he knows better. I know that he knows better. I don't know tangibly, but I'm assuming so with his level of education that he knows that there's more, but whatever. So I have some of these kind of young men who are, related to me familially, who I feel like, as we were discussing, have also been maybe broken in a way, by, I don't know if there was relationship trauma, if there was, they wanted to get into a program that they couldn't get into. And so they said, fuck it, I want to hang it up and just piss off and play video games and, whatever, So we've identified that that's part of a problem that could crush someone's spirit, and not empower them to become their authentic self, you know? And so they fall back into like the next rung below, which is probably living at home, doing some menial job that doesn't require a lot of responsibility, and then living subsistently off of, you know, whatever, ramen and I don't know, bong hits, you know?
You're really getting more and more bitter. I mean, it's not a good thing.
No, it's like, not. But my question, and you know, we could have a discussion because I've thought about this a lot, and maybe people know people like this, you know, who are our audience. And so I'd love to hear from people if they have this in their life or their family, or they know stories. How would you, and I'm saying you as in like Eric, the person, not like the proverbial you, like, how would you approach someone like this if that was kind of the case? You know, if that was your, it's not going to be your son because he's motivated at the age of 9 with chess. So like, it's not like, you know, but like if it was a nephew of yours or something like this, you know, that had kind of gone through life and never really found a niche for themselves and is now in their, you know, mid to late 20s, early 30s, looking like the life is kind of bleak. You know, like you can't say, oh, well, but you know what? They're really good at like DJing or they love X, Y, and Z. It's just kind of like, no, I couldn't tell you what they like. They're just doing.
Yeah, that's a weird one for me because I am interested in, it sounds like a weird thing to say. You have to be careful you say it. I find teenage kids psychologically fascinating. I was going to say I'm interested in teenage kids, but that sounds weird.
No, you didn't say that.
No. But I find them psychologically fascinating because it's such this, it's this window of like identity formation.
Yeah.
We get to the psych stuff. Like this is the Eric Erickson window of identity formation. I think we were talking about that a little bit. Ryan Davenport and I did an episode, you know, while Daniel was away on his retreats, right? And we did talk about this teenage years and this identity formation. And I think, you know, in my interactions with younger relatives or even like the kids of like family friends and things like that, it's really been like trying to encourage them for the things that they kind of love that are more intrinsic. You're already talking about someone who seems like they've lost that sense.
Oh, for sure.
But like, I don't know. Like I've tried to, in my interactions with people within my life, patience, I don't know. It's an interesting call. I don't know if I had a lot of patients that fit exactly into that mold. It just didn't seem to happen that way. It hasn't happened that way for me. That hasn't been my client base, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the one thing I say is like, you're looking for something that strikes intrinsic passion within people, you know?
Right.
And then that's the sort of the search for the authentic thing. That's with my son with the chess, why I'm so encouraging, whether he'll be a professional chess player or not, you know? That's a fucking crapshoot for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that you have something that you feel passionate about, I think you need that somehow, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
As a tool of like self-esteem, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know we were going to talk about this part, but it is kind of crazy. You know, my first kid was a daughter. And in having her, I did get aware of like, God, there really are different social pressures. They're experienced by, you know, girls and boys growing up in this culture, where for the girls, really the emphasis, and Alina is very honest about this, it's kind of like, are you pretty? You know, how pretty can you make yourself look,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you pose just the right way on Instagram to like catch the right angle? You know, like this kind of stuff. And then also the question of like social skill. Can you navigate through complex social environments and like do that?
Yeah.
And I wasn't prepared for that at all. I mean, I had grown up with a brother. I hadn't grown up in a household with any girls.
Mm-hmm.
I was sick when I was a teenager. So I didn't get this world in that way. I felt like, you know, from the boy's side, though, you have to try to be good at something. Otherwise, it's really bad for your self-esteem.
Yeah, it's more merit-based for sure.
Yeah, it's merit-based. And so I guess the thing I would try to look at for those folks is like, we have to start getting something that you can feel good about yourself with.
Right.
Clinical psychology wise, it reminds me of the Alfred Adler problem.
Mm.
So he's interesting in that Jung kind of admired him too and would use his stuff as well. So I got interested in him a little bit through Jung, though I learned a little about him anyways. But he, you know, kind of has this thing where you have to work on your self-esteem, right? And if you have low self-esteem, it's pretty hard to do anything.
Yeah.
Now, anyone can have low self-esteem. That's true. We're not just talking about young men.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the idea is that you have to do things that you can feel proud of. Otherwise, you can end up in situations of avoidance, which it sounds like that's what you're describing.
Yeah.
I give up. I'm going to avoid life.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Or conditions of dependency. I'm just going to rely on this other person to protect me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or, you know, on the paradoxical side, situations where I'm going to prove myself by like dominating others. So he has that as an idea too. I'll build my own self-esteem by like standing on your head.
Yeah. Like a bully.
Bullying. And yeah, these kind of artificial ways of like, I'll boost my own ego by making you feel worse.
Right.
You know,
right. I'm not actually inflating myself. I'm lowering you.
Yeah. 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 I'm not improving myself. I'm making you seem crappier to the other people around us so we can all make you look bad. So I feel better about myself. Yeah. So he kind of, he points those things out as like strategies of what people do when they feel bad about themselves. Right. It sounds like that's an avoidant thing. And then the answer in the psych thing is you got to like set some goals. I mean, Jordan Peterson talks this way, to be honest, right? But you got to like set some goals, things that you can kind of start to achieve and feel good about yourself. That's a whole Jordan Peterson, like clean your room, you know, do these kind of mundane things that'll make you feel better about yourself. And then, you know, do things that are like a benefit to other people too, right? So you can get out of the side of a narcissistic headspace.
That is not a Jordan Peterson thing.
That may or may not be. I think he does think that's good. But some of that means some of the good you're going to do is you're going to join MAGA and, you know, like that's going to be some of the good you're going to do in the world.
Yeah.
Take America back and make it great again and
Put
a brick in the border wall or whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
He wants to do. Yeah. I don't know. He has the wackiest ass philosophy in the world. If you want to hear something weird, try to understand him. It's a mix of like Carl Jung, Christianity, existentialist philosophers. And like MAGA, you're like, this shit does not combust together.
That's right, yeah.
Like, this does not work. So weird. Such a weirdo. And he dresses really strange, and I'm the guy wearing this hat.
Well.
But he dresses fucking weird, dude.
Yeah, well, all right, well.
And I'm saying it. Yeah. Oh, he has all these weird, have you seen these videos?
Yeah, I have.
He has all these weird suits made. And
I know.
I don't want to plug the videos because some people will go and maybe potentially watch. And if you watch one Jordan Peterson video, the algorithm will never fucking leave you alone with him. You'll get every single goddamn video.
Yeah.
Even if you're watching the one that's making fun of him. Anyways, that's a Jordan Peterson thing. But you know, don't you think that's kind of it? I mean, I think others wise on that, if you want to get like practical about it.
Yeah.
And I guess when you're dealing with people who have that level of despondency, it's hard, but you have to try to ignite something that they feel passionate about, I suppose, or at least something they can feel good about themselves with. Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one is built on top of the other. You can, if you're passionate about something, then you can feel good about doing it, you know? And then if you have a place that you could implant that energy into, it can grow. And then that's something that you could stand on. That's a real brick in the border wall, you know,
a real one.
A real brick. Yeah. And then you can start to
kind of tower leading to the heavens, not a wall dividing you from other people to like make yourself feel more secure.
But it does help you. But it is, I think it is also important for people like that to feel like they have some boundary, you know, between the outside world and themselves. Not to keep protection from, but to feel like they do have a respite, you know, a place that they can kind of go and not have to keep the facade up or whatever. Because I think for some people, they don't want to be seen, actually, you know, because for men in particular, we're talking, or women, if they don't believe in themselves to be pretty or attractive or something like that, they're not going to want to show themselves, you know, same thing, men, if you don't feel like you have a skill, you're not going to want to be public facing because what do I have to bring to the table? You know, you're not a blank. So you're just now some random person. Now you're worse than being a loser. You're faceless. You know, you're just like an NPC in the crowd.
Yeah, like the non-player character. Yeah.
You're just some other fucking schmo, you know, and people don't want to feel like that. They want to feel like they have something unique, something to give in a male perspective, what we're saying right now. But if you don't feel like you have that, that is completely disempowering. So having a place where you don't feel like you need to put on your face is important, you know, but at the same time, if you never have the opportunity to put something on to show somebody else, it might be because you don't feel like you have anything to put on in the first place. And so then you're going to revert back to the things that you were saying, you know, earlier about others in the response to these kinds of things that, okay, I'm going to put somebody else down. I'm going to, you know, be despondent, like whatever the reaction to that's going to be. So
Yeah, I mean, the self-esteem applies to everybody, really, no matter who you are, right? Yeah. You know, no matter who you are, you need to feel good about yourself. That's Adler's point, right? And I think he's right. You need to feel good about yourself in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you go back to like, okay, so, yeah, so I didn't, that was kind of interesting thing to talk about. I didn't know we were going that direction. I don't know what up with those kinds of people as far as like family of origin problems. I don't know what, you know, entirely that's about. You know, I mean, you know, from your own family thing with that. Obviously, it seems like part of what happens in the discussion is like families can crush people.
Yeah.
That we can see.
Yeah.
Right. And, or families can free people.
For sure.
So maybe the spiritual part is to go and say, can you function as a family member that can help people find them, their self-esteem, help people find their authenticity,
mm-hmm.
and help them find their freedom?
Hope. Yeah. I mean, that would
help
be
them find their freedom.
That would be the positive thing to help people do, right? I mean, that's the spark, but you have to know about that in the first place, you know?
Well, I mean, I think that's like, as far as this little podcast goes, why I know from my side, I try to like, say if Alfred Adler comes up, I'll try to do like a mini sketch on him.
Yeah.
You know, okay, let's just do it, because it at least puts a context of like, then you look at that kid in your life, you're like, okay, well, here's a little theory I can try out.
Mm-hmm.
This kid needs something that he can feel some self-esteem about.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's like, I mean, you've done personal training in your life with people. Maybe that's going to the gym and you start working out. You start feeling better about yourself that way. You know,
I have,
you know,
always done very well in terms of being influential on teenage males,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
always since the beginning of my, you know, working as a trainer. And I have a lot of men in my acupuncture practice, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I probably 50% at least.
That's more so than the average, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, there, you know, there, if you don't know that the acupuncture world, there's a lot more female patients than males.
By far.
Yeah.
It's probably,
so what do you think that's thirds. Totally about? Like, why do you think that is?
I don't know. I can say that I think because I've worked so long as a trainer, I have this kind of motivational aspect to myself. That's like, okay, I'm doing the Adler thing. Okay, let's set some goals for yourself. Let's work on, you know, your food habits. I'm like, just meditate, eat whatever you want, whatever. Fuck it. You know, like I can't win every battle, but do that. Okay. You don't want to do that? All right, fine. Then don't eat so shitty. Like stop drinking or what, you know, whatever the case is.
Uh-huh.
But I think that men from my experience are a little bit more prone to that kind of influence. You know, they're a little bit more accepting of that kind of thing. Like, okay, all right. I get it. You know, like I'll do it.
I mean, it's entirely possible that there's probably a certain amount of men that will take that better from a male clinician.
Yes.
They'll take that kind of structuring and ordering.
Correct.
It could be good for anyone to get that from anyone, but it's like, if you're realistic about it, probably for some guys, it's like, okay, if I heard that from my sister, I wouldn't listen to that stuff. But hearing from this guy, I'm going to listen to him. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I have, and of course I have female patients who really love that also,
yeah.
You know, but again, it part of it is the messenger. Actually, it's not always just the message. And so for people who are into that, I think they enjoy the reminder. They enjoy coming and being challenged a little bit and having somebody hold them accountable. So for those who are into that, that's good. And that, and in this case, tends to bring in a little bit more male patient, you know?
Yeah. I could see it. Well, I mean, you know, obstacle number two, I guess, you know, to me, it's the negative side. I think there's, in the Buddha story, there's obviously the idea, and I'm going to keep hitting this point throughout all of our episodes we ever do, but if you have to break with it, you have to break.
Yeah.
Right. And there's no doubt for me, like there was certain times when I had to break with my family, and I did, you know. It was like, I can't be around these people in this way. For me to progress as a spiritual being, and I knew the Buddha story. I mean, and I obviously, it's not a hard story to crack. I mean, I understand the implication of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like what we were talking, even we were talking off mic, like what we wanted to do is apply these spiritual teachings to our actual lives to see how they really work. And part of that was, okay, you know, Buddha had to break, you know, to spiritually find himself. Otherwise, you kind of get driven into wherever the momentum of the family thing might go in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, I'm going to have to break. And I never like, you know, I came from a house where there was abuse and there were problems. I never fully broke up. Like, I didn't talk to my family at all, but I did distance myself for a certain period of time until I refound who I was. And that was like really through kind of the Zen years of my life mm-hmm. and doing that. So I kind of have taken that message home.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, you know, you might have to do that, right? And there's the acknowledgement that unfortunately, a lot of times it's the people who are closest to you that will create yeah. the worst limitations on who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Carl Rogers point too, you know? It's the people who around you that will create the, he uses this phrase, conditions of worth. They'll put up the criteria that you have to follow in order to meet their demands, the conditions of worth. And if you don't do them, they'll probably maybe should force you to do them, or you'll get a lot of negative feedback. Like maybe some of the people who are suffering with this self-esteem, they're not getting the family support for this. I don't know, you know, but anyways, like, you know, you might have to do this thing and break, you know, I know it's going to pan out with, you know, my son, there's this interesting thing. He's in the crowd of these kids, and it was weird because some of them were already talking about like, I'm going to go and become an accountant, or I'm going to go and become a data analyst. And you're like, you're 11 years old. You're dreaming of being a data analyst. That's all family pressure. Like, no one dreams of being a data analyst.
Yeah, I mean,
at 11, you want to be a firefighter or like Captain America or Spider-Man. Yeah. Or...
I wanted to be a Pokemon. I was like, I just want that, you know.
That's right. That's correct. You know, you want to be He-Man. Go fight some Skeletor in some alternate dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Not a data analyst.
No.
So, I mean, you could kind of see that my point in bringing it up is those pressures are still out there on kids. You can still feel it.
There is. I think on the positive side, those kinds of pressures make it such that you have something to break out of.
Yeah. Kabbalistic attitude. You know, if you have an external obstacle, it builds your will
mm-hmm.
to like push through it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, how'd you feel about it? I think that did happen for me, you know, that there was this thing of like pushing through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was writing some notes down. I'm just jogging my memory about times where that happened for me for sure. And those are some of the deepest beliefs that I have, actually.
Because the ones you fought for?
Yeah. Because they came from a place of unwavering faith and belief.
Conviction, right?
Mm-hmm. That came, but they were. The words were an external manifestation of a feeling, of a knowing, of a sense of being, you know, of sense of this is right, you know, and I don't care how old I am or what the face is or what the pressure is. I am not changing to acquiesce. I'm not, you cannot tell me that this is not right. Just can't do it.
Yeah, that's a little bit why you and I get along.
Right.
If we find that, we recognize that in one another. Mm. And you get to the point where like, I decided this is the correct one.
Yeah.
You know, and then other people can do what they want. That's cool. I'm not judging anybody else, but I've decided this is the one, and I will not be budgeable on this point.
Not budgeable.
Yeah.
Not at all.
I mean, only the last thing I say that like maybe has a little emotional content for me in this is when my dad did pass, in that weird time, you know, where spirit separates from matter, you know, Chinese medical thought, Tibetan Buddhist thought, these kinds of spiritual ideas, I had a lot of what felt like spiritual messaging, right? I was there, even when he was comatose, I was sitting there, and I'd be, you know, holding his hand or, you know, putting my hand on his wrist and being in contact with him. And I'd be meditating. My dad wasn't a meditative guy, you know, but, that experience is so powerful if you've been through it, because you really feel like the spirit of the person. There's a lot of energy there in that experience. When someone is passing, you know, that all the power of the spirit is separating from matter would be the way you would talk about this, right? Tibetan Book of the Dead and so on. And it's a lot of energy. I suppose it's subtle in the sense that, you know, it's not like a bomb blowing off exactly, but in a certain level, it has almost what feels like a nuclear level of power to it, right? This is the thing that animates life, is separating from this matter. And I'm sure other people have been through this thing too. You start to, all your thoughts about that person start to clarify. It's almost like your two spirits are speaking between each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in your quiet inner language to one another, right? Things are clarifying. And as far as what you were talking about, the message I got from my dad was like, I'm sorry I had to be so tough on you. I'm sorry I had to be kind of a dick at times. It was, and he almost got the feeling like it was a Zen thing, you know, like you needed to develop that perseverance to do the things that you believed in against obstacles. And I knew if you developed that through, you know, our even things that were kind of crap in the family, and I'm sorry about that, but it was developing this strength of character that you would do what you want. I guess it's like the Johnny Cash song, Boy Named Sue. Guy names his kid Sue, and then it, you know, makes him tough or whatever. But it, I did have that feeling, you know, and that, that was a very healing thing for me.
Yeah.
So maybe that's like kind of the other side of this. You know, if you do have to like have conflict with family of origin, whether you're Buddha or just some goofball like me, in the end, you can, you know, it doesn't have to be where you can't have a reconciliation and a healing at the end.
Right.
You might have to go on your own way, but you can still heal in the end.
Yeah.
Right? And that's good to know too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. What do you think? Anything else on it?
No, I think that's good.
I think it did it justice, yeah. Right?
Yeah. I think so.
And yeah. So, I mean, maybe the morals would be, if you have to break, you have to break. Buddha did.
Yeah.
But if we are with family members or other people that we love, like what the family members you're talking about, well, you can be that thing that can be the opposite of that, not the oppressive force, but the liberating force.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and ultimately you got to do what's authentically yourself. Right.
And that will, if you can help other people find their authenticity, then that's how you avoid doing this, right? You help the people you love, the kids or the other family members, find their source of authenticity.
Yeah.
And self-esteem, right? Those two things probably go together. All right, well, that seems good. I think we did obstacle number two.
I think so.
Yeah. All right, so. Cool.
All right. Well, as always, Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you, Daniel.
Audience, thanks everybody for tuning in. If you're checking us out on some platform, whichever one you're onto, whether it's YouTube or Apple or Spotify or whatever, you know, give us a like, subscribe. It helps. Share the show, things like this. Send us an email, jinandtantra@gmail.com. Hit us up on the old Instagram, you know, slide into our DMs, and we'll get back to you for sure. As always, Eric, thanks so much for doing this with me. Thanks again to our audience for tuning in now for like year 3.5, coming up on 4 in a few months. It's crazy to think about how quickly time is moving, but you know, it's a labor of love, as we always like to say, and we appreciate all of the love that we get back from everybody. So for Eric, this is Daniel. We'll catch everybody on the next one. Peace.
I want you to get together. I want you to get together.